Well, thank you, Paul. Good afternoon, family. Happy Sabbath to everybody here, wherever you are. I hope you're doing well, staying strong. As I thought and prayed about what to speak on here today, one word kept sticking in my mind: empathy. Empathy, I thought, but I don't really know too much about that. I don't consider it necessarily a strength of mine. And I think that was part of the point. But another part of the point for all of us here today, why we're going to speak about it, is found in 2 Timothy. Please turn over to 2 Timothy. Second Timothy 3. Here Paul is writing to Timothy, and I'm going to read from the Amplified Version. He says, "But understand this, that in the last days, dangerous times of great stress and trouble will come, difficult days that'll be hard to bear. For people will be lovers of self, narcissistic, self-focused, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy and profane. They'll be unloving, devoid of natural human affection, calloused and inhumane, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, devoid of self-control, brutal, haters of good, traitors, reckless, conceited, lovers of sensual pleasure rather than lovers of God." Quite a long list. No wonder Paul says these will be stressful times. And as I think about all of the different attributes and attitudes listed there, there's a common thread among them. Yes, a lack of God in their life, but another common thread, and that is a lack of connection with anyone outside of themselves. Paul says people will be narcissistic and self-focused. They're going to have an inward concern, inward focus, disobedient to parents, you know, a disruption in the connection between parent and child that God intended. Devoid of human affection and irreconcilable. So your ties with other people will be severed. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Disconnected from God. When our concern is so much focused inwardly, we lose any real connection with our family, our friends, and God above. Paul says this is how many people will be as we approach the end. And even prior to 2020, our society has kind of trended this way. Remember hearing a few years ago that teenagers, when they turn 16, no longer are going to get their driver's licenses right away. And I was shocked when I heard that. I said, why not? I said, because they're not motivated, you know, they're not all getting together and meeting up. They're all right here on their phones, online, gaming, you know, seemingly connected, but not really so. Researchers who study empathy and relationships have noted people self-report to be less empathetic, and that trend has been happening since the 1980s, but sharply declining in the last 10 years. You know, we don't need a lot of statistics here to prove this point. We all experience this every day. We see it in the news. And in 2020, of course, with widespread lockdowns and isolations and social distancing, plays right into this. So let's address this issue today, the lack of a real connection, and let's address it together today. And the title of the message is Connecting Through Empathy. Connecting Through Empathy. I did a sermon search on our database, and I found 9 results on empathy, and one was a duplicate, so 8 results. And I found about 4 times as many on compassion, and over 500 on love. So this may be something we're a little bit unaware of its importance. So let's dive in. Empathy is defined as the ability to understand and share in the feelings of another. It's described sometimes as catching the feelings of someone else. Like, we don't ever want to catch COVID, but if you catch a cold from someone else, now you feel what they were feeling. It means to put yourselves, of course, in the shoes of someone else emotionally. Empathy is easily confused with other things like sympathy and compassion, even codependency, etc. But instead of reading all the different definitions of these words, I want to provide just a brief example to help illustrate the difference here. If someone were to come to me in a private conversation and say, you know, I just lost my job, If I was sympathetic towards them, I'd feel sorry for them. I'd say, I'm sorry. That sounds terrible. If I was compassionate towards them, I may want to help try and fix it, right? Compassion spurs you to action. You love that person. Let me help you with the resume. Let me help you get you connected to somebody, showing compassion for them. But empathy is different. Empathy is mostly listening and being there with that person until you start feeling that awful feeling, that shock of being fired, you know, of being losing your job unexpectedly. And empathy's kind of become a buzzword, at least secularly, in the last few years. But is it biblical? That's something I had to ask myself as I was preparing this message. Please turn over to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 10. Here Moses is recounting God's instructions to Israel. He's going over, you know, the important basics, things like fearing and loving God. And he goes on here, and let's pick it up in verse 16. He tells them, "Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. He administers justice for the fatherless and widow, and he loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing." Moses says, make your hearts tender towards others. God is tender towards others, and he's just. Then he says something interesting in verse 19. "Therefore, love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." There's something simple there, but did you catch it? Moses, is in his words, says, love the stranger, have compassion for them. And how does he say that they can do this? By realizing you were a stranger before. You understand how it feels. You can empathize with them. I've heard empathy could be the spark that ignites compassion. And here Moses is saying, have compassionate love for them by empathizing with them. Empathy should be just a part of the way we interact with other people. You know, not everyone, of course, is on the same part of their spiritual journey as we are. And so when we encounter somebody who's maybe weak in the faith or new in the faith, do we empathize with them and try to understand and remember what that was like and connect with them? Or do we find ourselves judging them for a lack of faith, which disconnects us from them? When we see someone struggling in sin, do we remember that we struggle with sin at times and empathize and connect with them and help them and be there with them through that? Or do we judge them? Again, disconnecting ourselves from them. I looked up the antonym to empathy, right? The opposite of empathy is distance. It makes sense, because if you're not empathizing with somebody, you're emotionally distant from them. And it's not easy to empathize. It takes conscious effort to see outside of your own point of view. You know, I find my default is to experience life inwardly. And when I'm with other people, I want them to understand me. I want them to hear me. Distant conscious effort to flip that around and ask ourselves, am I understanding other people? Am I recognizing what they're going through? Am I empathizing and connecting with them where they are? Please turn to the book of Jonah. Jonah is an interesting story that may not be the first book you'd think of when you think of empathy. I want to look at a few things here in the book of Jonah. Jonah 1, verse 1. I want to consider his story through the lens of empathy. Verse 1. "Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, 'Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me.' But Jonah arose and fled to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord." Now Jonah didn't like the task that he was given. He tried to disconnect and flee away from God. And his thoughts here started to turn inward. It's evident that that's the headspace he was in for the entire rest of the story, about how much he didn't want to do this mission. And we're not going to read the entire story, but we're familiar with it. Looking at an overview, he gets on this boat to flee, and the storm kicks up. And the crew that's on board with him, they're getting panicked. They're getting anxious. They're scared. They're afraid. And they wake up Jonah and they say, look, we're about to die. We're perishing. And understand, Jonah knows why this is happening. He confesses to it in verse 9 later. But really picture Jonah here, being in Jonah's shoes. These men come to you and they're afraid for their lives. But yet, you're unaffected by that. It's of no concern of yours. You're disconnected from them because you're just thinking about how much you don't want to do what you've been assigned to do. You know, the other men eventually had to cast lots to get to the bottom of it. And then Jonah confesses. And then you'd think, okay, maybe he's going to start empathizing. Maybe he'll start seeing their position. And remember, empathy will spark you to compassion, doing something for them. Maybe he'll pray to God for them. Hey, these people don't deserve that. Maybe he'll at least row alongside of them, do something. But he does nothing. Because again, this is all happening to him. In Jonah's mind, it's all happening to Jonah. And it's always struck me the position that he put these crew members in. These crew members who are voicing their fear of this God. They're showing fear of God, and Jonah says, yeah, that God that you fear, I'm a man of God, so pick me up and throw me into the sea. I mean, it's completely disconnected from an understanding and realizing their situation, their experience. And we know the rest of the story. The Ninevites repented, God relents, he has mercy on them, and Jonah becomes angry. And it's always found it strange, just curious, the way the story ended with this plant that springs up and then withers away and dies, which makes Jonah angry. And I said, that's just a strange ending. But notice the question at the very end. Let's go to Jonah 4, verse 10 and 11. But the Lord said, Jonah, you've had pity on the plant for which you have not labored, nor made it grow, which came up in a night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city, which are more than 120,000 people who can't discern between their right hand and their left, and much livestock? The concluding question and lesson here is God's noting that Jonah had pity for a plant, something that benefited him, but he doesn't have any pity or sympathy, much less empathy, for these 120,000 Ninevites. And take that a step further. God says something good's happened here. They repented. And when people repent, God rejoices. He's joyous. He's filled with joy. But is Jonah sharing in that? No, he's angry. Instead, Jonah's attitude's a lot more like 2 Timothy 3 that we started off here. Self-focused, calloused, devoid of human affection, haters of good, unloving. He finds himself in this story disconnected from God, disconnected from those crew members, and disconnected from the Ninevites. And at the very end of the story, at the end of the account, we see Jonah's completely alone. He's isolated, and he's miserable. And if we're not careful, we can find ourselves in a similar state to Jonah. Even if we're not physically alone, mentally we can feel alone and isolated. And that's if we're strictly inwardly focused, because we're not connected to anybody else. For the rest of the message, I want to look at how we can avoid this in our lives in two parts. The first part is by connecting with God through empathy. And the second part, of course, is connecting with each other through empathy. So part one, connecting with God through empathy. When you think of God, do you think of an empathetic being? Remember what empathy is. It's the ability to share and understand the feelings of someone else. I think we can all say God loves me and God cares for me, but that's not what I'm asking. When you go to God in prayer, are you before an empathetic God? Please turn to Hebrews 4. Many of you know where I'm headed here on this scripture. We read it a lot. Hebrews 4, and I'm going to read from the King James Version, Hebrews 4:15. For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Christ is at the right hand of God and is able to be touched with the feeling of our struggles, our weaknesses, our infirmities. The New Living Translation says, actually, he empathizes with us. Now, I want to read from the Amplified Version, which uses a little bit different language. Hebrews 4:15. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize. So they use sympathize here, but look what they say. And understands our weaknesses and temptations, but one who has been tempted, knowing exactly how it feels to be human in every respect as we are, yet without committing any sin. So really consider this question again. When you go before God in prayer, are you before an empathetic being? We know God's concerned and he's compassionate. We know John 3:16, that compassion has led him to giving his only begotten son. But it's not the same as empathy. Does he actually, at times, share our feelings alongside us? Please turn to the book of John. Here, we'll look at the beginning of the book. We're going to look at the story of Jesus and Lazarus. John 11. John 11, and we'll read verse 1. John 11, verse 1. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. Now dropping down to verse 4. When Jesus heard that Lazarus was sick, he said, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Says there's a purpose here. There's a reason this is happening. And in the next several verses, we see Jesus waits around a few days before he then heads in to Bethany to see Lazarus. Look at verse 17. So when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, according to the manners and customs of the Bible, according to that book, the Jews at this time believed a person's spirit hovered around the dead body for 3 days seeking reentrance, but then after that time would leave. So by resurrecting Lazarus on the 4th day, he was leaving no doubt in the Jews' mind what he was doing and the power that he had in resurrecting Lazarus. And that underscores the importance of what he was doing, of the purpose of all this. Now picture what's happening. Christ comes in to Bethany, and he knows what he's about to do. He knows his mission, and he's 100% sure he's about to bring Lazarus back to life. Now, if he was strictly inwardly focused, he would march straight forward and go and demonstrate his power. And certainly, he'd have every right to do that. He is powerful. He is holy. He is just. But what does he do instead? Verse 33. Therefore, when Jesus saw Mary weeping, and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." And Jesus wept. He came into Bethany and he looked around. He observed what was going on. He didn't leave them alone in their feelings. He grieved alongside them. Hebrews 4:15 tells us that Christ can empathize with us. And this example shows us that he does empathize with us. Christ, being of one mind with the Father, we can be certain God has empathy towards us. He's willing to share in the grief alongside us in times of sorrow. And when we understand that, it should encourage even more of a connection with God, an even deeper relationship with him. Now take this event from Martha and Mary's point of view. If Christ had come in and skipped over being empathetic, if he had skipped over that and just went forward and resurrected your brother, certainly you'd be in awe of his power. Right? Certainly, you would be grateful for his compassionate act. But you, by empathizing with them, he showed a very personal concern. He had a connection with them, an intimate connection that helped in their relationship and helps to show us we're not alone with what we're going through. Now, I want to address something here about this example, because perhaps you may have heard that in the verses we just read, Christ actually wasn't experiencing empathy at all. That when he was groaning in the spirit, he was becoming angry. It was a groan, kind of an anger. That's how the New Living Translation translates it. And that's about 4 or 5 other translations out of the 40 that I looked at. That's how they translate it. A small minority of translations, to be sure, but the argument's out there, and perhaps some of you have learned that interpretation. But in William Barclay's Daily Study Bible, he notes that is an error in translation, and I absolutely agree, because if you think about Psalm 86:15, we know God is slow to anger. And knowing that about God, let's look back through this story just briefly, and I want us to really internalize what's going on. We're going to look at a few scriptures within John 11 that we didn't look at the first time. Verse 3, "Therefore the sisters sent to Christ, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. So the account starts by making special note of the fact that Christ loves Lazarus. Verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister Mary and Lazarus. Again, John's inspired by God here to make special note of Christ's love for Martha and Mary and Lazarus. It's repeated here, which only emphasizes it. Now, as Jesus comes into Bethany, there's all this weeping and the emotion in question, right? The groaning of Christ in verse 33. I want to look what happened right before this. What led him to this? Verse 32. Then when Mary, remember, who Jesus loved, came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. Here's Jesus, who's slow to anger. Could this statement by Mary be starting to stir something? Something, you know, could he be starting to get angry internally at what she said? What he does next, I think, gives us a clue. Verse 33, therefore, when Jesus saw Mary weeping. That word saw means to look upon or contemplate. She falls down at his feet, and he takes note of it. He contemplates what she's going through. The precise definition of empathy. He shared in her grief by also weeping himself in verse 35. And the encounter shows us exactly what it's like when we find ourselves weeping and we go before God. He takes note of that, and he's willing to weep with us. Now, it's very possible later in this account that Jesus did become frustrated with the Jews as they were chastising him, saying different things, you know, much like the Pharisees did often. We're not looking at how he dealt with those people who were refusing to believe in him. This story is about not only Christ's power resurrecting Lazarus, this story is about his love for Martha and Mary and Lazarus. And John tells us that all along the way. And when I studied this story in detail this time, I picked up on something, just a small thing that I hadn't really thought about in that way before. Remember what Christ was saying initially. We've gone over it. In verse 4, he says, there's a reason why this is happening. The death of Lazarus is not by mistake. It's not a random event. There was a purpose, and it was to glorify God. So you could say Lazarus dying here was God's will that that happened. So why am I pointing this out? Because in our life, when we encounter trials and difficulties, and I'm not talking about the difficulties we can bring on ourselves with improper behavior, I'm talking about those hard struggles, those hard trials that God puts us through at times. He allows us to go through. It very may well be his will that we're going through it. There may be something we need to learn there. And when I'm going through something like that, I think in my mind, okay, God's putting me through this, I'm going to get, you know, he wants me to get through it. He's waiting there for me at the end of this. That's wrong. He's right there with me. He's right there with us. When you're hurting and you fall at his feet, he takes note of that, of your struggle, and he empathizes with us. And prior to now, I didn't think fully understand the depth of what that means. Barclay's commentary says verse 35, the verse that says Jesus wept, says this would have been the most astonishing part of the story for the Greeks and Gentiles, because they believed that God was emotionless. They reasoned that if God had emotions and could experience emotions, then by feeling sorry for you or experiencing grief, then that person can have somehow influence God or have some kind of power or influence over him. You know, if we think this way, perhaps it's difficult to imagine God being truly empathetic with us. But it's interesting to note in verse 35 when it says Jesus wept, that's a different word than what is used to show that Mary and Martha were weeping. When Mary and Martha were weeping, that's a loud wailing, and it's a natural human response to death. But when Christ wept, dakruo, the Greek word, means he shed tears. It means he shed tears. And it's hard to pin down the precise difference between the two words, but the way I see it, Christ was fully God and fully man. Here he was fully weeping, yet fully sure of what he was about to do. He felt the pain of the moment. He cried. He wept. He shed tears. And there are no false tears with Christ. But he also knew what he was about to do. In Philippians 2, verses 6 through 7, Paul says, Christ didn't consider it robbery that he was equal with God, but that he gave that up. He humbled himself and he came in the likeness of man. Similarly, this example shows us that God does not consider it robbery that while he knows with full confidence what is happening, he knows why it's happening, he knows what good is going to come from it. He's fully confident of that, but he doesn't consider it emotional robbery to come and meet us in our weeping, in our grief. And in verse 35, as Christ was weeping, note the effect that it had. Verse 36, it says, "See how Christ loved him." When you empathize with people, they feel that love. Maya Angelou once said, "People may forget what you tell them, but they'll never forget how you made them feel." Christ's empathy here, I'm sure, was never forgotten by Martha and Mary, how it made them feel, the connection that it created. And in fact, later we find the same Mary who had fallen down at Christ's feet here. We find her later falling down at the feet of Christ again before he has to go through his trial and washing his feet, an act of love and service with those expensive perfumes in Matthew 26. She never forgot it. Connecting with God through empathy isn't only, though, about understanding that God has empathy towards us. Do we ever try as best we can to empathize with God? Do we ever think on how Israel, his chosen people in the Old Testament, he took them out, he worked with them, he was patient with them, only to have them reject him and want a human king? Do we think about Matthew 23:27, where Christ says, "How often I wanted to gather you together, as a hen gathers her chicks, but you weren't willing"? Do we set in our minds on how it must feel to patiently train and stick with these disciples, only to have every single one of them desert and flee from him? Do we wonder what it's like to give your only son or to die for someone, and that same person is too busy with their life to even want to come and talk to you? Our high priest understands the feelings of rejection, betrayal, pain, and suffering. We're not alone. We're not isolated. He never intended for us to feel that way. We should have that closeness, that relationship with him. Please flip forward a couple pages to John 13. John 13, verse 34. Christ says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. As Christ has shown us love, so we are to love each other." And part of that love is empathizing with each other. So part two, connecting with each other through empathy. We're born with the ability to empathize. We might even be predisposed or inclined to it. I heard about a study where psychologists were asking pre-K children, and four-year-olds, "Why do you not hit another child?" And one of the children said, "Because it hurts the skin." So they weren't saying because it was wrong or mom and dad told me not to do it. They were understanding how it feels, because it hurts the skin. I know when I'm reading a book with Evelyn, you know, Evie, five monkeys jumping on the bed and one falls off and bumps her head and she bends over and gives a little love on the head. She's bumped her head quite a few times. She knows how that feels. But like most anything else, you can strengthen this ability or you can let it fade away and atrophy. Jesus says in Matthew 24, "As lawlessness abounds, the love, that is the agape, the outgoing concern for others, waxes cold." As times get more and more stressful, it's natural for us to turn inward, right? Disconnecting from others. But we must, in fact, be marching onward to the millennium. We should be strengthening this ability. And I think that's why the Bible tells us, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together, even more so as you see the day approaching, as times get more stressful. Now, over the last few years, I've noticed a dangerous sentiment that I've often heard and read people saying, and that goes something like this: "You could never understand my truth. You could never know how I feel." Now, sometimes they're saying this because the other person isn't trying to empathize. They're offering unwanted advice or sometimes even being judgmental. But at other times, they're shutting you off. They're saying, "Don't even try to understand. You could never do it." And I think that's a sad attitude because it destroys any potential connection between them and another person. So should we accept that as true? Should we allow it to discourage us from trying to empathize with other people? Please turn to Exodus 2. Exodus 2, we'll read one verse, verse 11. Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. So here's Moses, a prince in Egypt at this time. What did his day-to-day experience have anything to do with the Hebrew slaves in Egypt? Couldn't have been any different. I mean, a good man there might have gone out and sympathized, saw what they were going through and said, man, that is terrible. And then you get back on with your life. But here it says Moses went out and looked at their burdens. That phrase there means to experience. It means to see so that one can learn to know. He was trying to learn to understand what they were going through. He was empathizing with them, as Christ did with Mary. Here a prince had put himself in the shoes of a slave. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12 that one's a hand, another's a foot, but that we have need for each other as one body. And though he was speaking of a diversity of spiritual gifts, this idea applies equally to our diversity of experiences in life. We're all connected through one spirit. And as Paul says there, there should be no separation in the body, but members should have care one for another. And if one member suffers, all suffer with it. He doesn't say if one suffers, we feel sorry for that member. He says we suffer with that member. And how do we do that? Well, notice what Moses did here. Again, he didn't just go out and have pity on the slaves. He observed their burdens. He took time out. He took mental energy to think about what they must be going through. And clearly he deeply internalized this, as we can see from the fact that it sparked an act. Granted, it was a misguided act, as he killed the Egyptian slave master. Right? Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. It was misguided, but it sparked, his empathy sparked an act. It's hard to truly do this, I think, for us because, you know, for me, I feel like maybe it jeopardizes our enjoyment of life somehow. You know, it may spark us to act compassionately for somebody else because we may be doing great in our lives. And then to empathize with somebody may mean we have to leave that mentality for a moment. We have to suffer with somebody else. Moses' empathy, though, here was the beginning of a deep connection that he had with those people. As he later became perhaps the greatest human leader other than Jesus Christ. We saw, just remember the golden calf incident when God suggested maybe he would wipe out the Israelites, and we saw that Moses pled for those people. He was connected to those people. He had love for them. And since empathy connects us and creates such deep connections, why aren't we all motivated to do it all the time? We have to be honest, there are barriers of entry, is what I call them, barriers of entry to empathizing. I brainstormed a quick list of things that have kept me in the past from empathizing. Came up with four of them. Number one, simply not aware of empathy or its importance. When someone is telling me about a trial or a struggle, I feel sorry for them. I sympathize with them. I want to try to do something for them. I want to try to act compassionately towards them and help try and fix it. But I'm not realizing that when they open up to me, often the thing that's most helpful is simply being there with them, helping them bear that in that moment. Often, you can provide someone a connection at the very moment in their life they've lost a deep connection. So when I say, man, I'm so sorry that happened, you know, how can I help you? How can I fix this? I've skipped right over that part of empathizing with them and sharing that feeling with them. Now, someone once told me they had been going through a trial since they were a teenager with severe, unexplained physical pain. And they didn't know how to deal with that. And they started to open up to people about it. And they got responses like, well, you're too young to be sick. Or you'll learn what it's like to feel pain when you're older. Or you look fine, healthy to me. I don't think that was a malicious response from these people. I think they simply were not aware of the importance of empathizing. And by not empathizing, realizing kind of the pain that that can cause. So we may take time out to think about what have we been through and our trials and struggles and difficulties, that when we notice that, perhaps we can be there and empathizing with someone else going through that same thing. The second one, the second barrier to empathizing was empathy sounds impossible to do to me. I mean, am I supposed to be able to accurately identify and understand the feelings of everyone else all the time? But I found it's not that we should think of it so much like a mental puzzle, but that many people will reveal to you how they feel just by the way, just by their body language, just by their posture, just by the tone in their voice. But our part is we have to be present. We have to be observing that and looking for it. Jesus observed. Moses observed. You know, one example that I had heard in a sermon that, because I never knew how to talk with people that had a loss in their family or a huge illness or struggle that way. I'd been fortunate at that time not to have experienced that. So I always had trouble connecting with that. And they said, when they lost somebody, what they found was really connecting and really encouraging, comforting, was when people would say, you know, I looked up the diagnosis of that. I looked up everything that that person has to go through. And I feel how difficult that is. Because, you know, you understand their feelings better. You understand what it is they're going through. The third thing that keeps us from empathizing, I think, is it can sound overly draining or exhausting. This is a difficult one, probably for me the most difficult, because it requires wisdom when you're dealing with people. First, you can't just go out and empathize all the time and never come back and connect with God and kind of cast your cares on Him. You have to be doing that and recharging. And also, having empathy doesn't mean you mirror every feeling that someone else has all the time. You know, if I lose in a fantasy football game and I'm upset about it, you don't have to be upset with me about it. That's not the empathy that we're talking about. But it takes empathy it takes wisdom to know how best to empathize and when best to empathize, because there are attitudes out there that we talked about, like, you'll never understand me, and they shut you down, they shut you off. You know, in the attributes that we read in 2 Timothy 3, all those that we started out with, Paul actually says, from such people, turn away. You know, they're not allowing you to connect with them in any meaningful way. So it takes wisdom, because we do want to try and seek to empathize with others. The last one, empathy sounds like a downer. You know, I've got to empathize with everyone and be down all the time. And I think this is because we associate empathy with hard feelings, with struggles, the difficult times, right? We suffer with one another. But that's not the end of Romans. Many of you know where I'm going with this. Romans 12, verse 15 says, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. So part of empathizing is rejoicing and being joyful with those people who are rejoicing. And again, it's not feeling happy for them, it's rejoicing with them. And so a large part of this, I think, is on each individual, you know, each individual here, all of us, is we should be a rejoicing people. We should be in the good habit of rejoicing. We just were at the Feast of Tabernacles, where I'm sure you heard the verse, rejoice before the Lord at the feast. You know, and then Paul writes in Thessalonians, rejoice always. So for the most part, we should be a rejoicing people. And empathy means you experience and share in that joy with others. You know, when Paul said in 1 Corinthians 12, when one suffer, we all suffer, he also said right after that, when one member is honored, we all rejoice with them. And this part kind of sounds easy, right? Because who doesn't want to rejoice? But please turn over to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel 6. And I think the verse we just read in Romans, I think half of it may be easier for some, and half of it may be easier for others. But we're to do both. Let's look at 2 Samuel 6. Here, there's a lot of rejoicing going on. All of Israel's rejoicing. The ark is coming back into the city. Verse 14. 2 Samuel 6, verse 14. Then David danced. That means he whirled about before the Lord with all his might. But he was rejoicing. Now, verse 16. Now, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and whirling before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. Not in a rejoicing mood. Verse 20. Then David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." You know, have you ever been rejoicing or full of joy, and then someone around you is sour and they're in a bitter mood, and it just pops all that right out, and like a balloon, all the air goes out. It's almost a sickening feeling. So David here says, he says, "So David said to Michal, 'It was before the Lord.'" Going to the end of the verse, "Therefore I will play music before the Lord." David's response is kind of incredulous. He says, "I'm rejoicing before the Lord. How can you be upset with that?" Verse 23, "Therefore Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death." Quite a punishment. Found herself alone. It's interesting that Michal is referred here to as the daughter of Saul three times in just this short passage. Because she was the daughter of Saul. But every time it says Michal, the daughter of Saul. And I feel like it's emphasizing like father, like daughter, right? Because we remember when King Saul, all of Israel was rejoicing after Goliath was defeated, and they were chanting, and King Saul took offense to that chant, and he was not in a rejoicing mood. So he passed that on to his daughter. You know, another biblical example of this is the prodigal son. Son comes home, the father is overjoyed, they're throwing a big feast, and where's the brother? Outside. Unwilling to go in. Alone. Isolated. So maybe it isn't as easy as it sounds to rejoice with those who rejoice, because pride and jealousy, those types of things can get in the way. Again, if we're strictly inwardly focused, like 2 Timothy 3, and like Jonah, we're going to find it hard to experience internally the joy of others if we're not connected to them. Someone in my life that seemed to rejoice with me always was my grandfather, and his name was also Patrick. And I recalled many minor league baseball games that we would go to in the summer, and this was a minor league team that was, it was the minor league team of my favorite team, the Giants, and so I had a vested interest in it. I was really excited anytime something good happened. I was really happy about that. And anytime I would turn over, there he was, just as excited, just as happy. And thinking about him reminded me of a story my Uncle Keith told me about his dad, my grandfather, same person. My Uncle Keith played junior high football, and he remembers to this day having a game. It was a road game, so it was quite a distance away. You had to travel to go see it. And he said it was so cold. It was the coldest he ever remembered playing a game in Louisiana. And it was a junior high game, so there weren't many people there. And the opponent was a big favorite. You know, they were going to clean their clocks, essentially. But here my uncle is. He's playing defense. He's in the middle of the game. Quarterback makes a bad pass. He jumps and intercepts it, and he just takes off. And he's sprinting. And he sees the end zone. He knows he's about to score. And he turns to the left. And there's my grandfather running down the sidelines, step for step with him. He scores a touchdown, and he's celebrating, and my grandfather's celebrating. He's sharing in that excitement, the joy of the moment. And sports is an interesting example to consider here, because if you've ever been to a stadium, you've got the crowd there, and something's happening on the field, and it's something good, and they're all rising to their feet as something really exciting is happening. They're all cheering on and sharing those feelings of excitement. So I want to end in Acts chapter 7. Perhaps an unusual example when we're discussing joy. But here Stephen is as he's being stoned in verse 55. Acts 7, 55. "But Stephen, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God." When we read about God in the scripture, he's sitting at the right hand of God, Colossians 3:1, Ephesians 1:20, several other places, we read about Christ sitting at the right hand of God. And here Stephen is. He's at this moment that, yes, his physical life is ending, but he's experiencing joy because he knows he gets to spend eternity with Jesus Christ. And he looks up and Christ says, I'm right here, standing with you. Verse 56, and said, look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. It's repeated. It's emphasizing. Stephen is exclaiming some joy here. And what he sees is Christ standing right there with him. We don't ever have to feel alone or isolated. It's not how God intended it. God empathizes with us. And we should empathize with each other. And we should strengthen this ability more and more as we move forward towards the millennium, using that to serve alongside Jesus Christ.